From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Washington Watch. Coming up, should the words and actions of a lawyer on behalf of a client be considered if that lawyer is nominated to the federal court? What if those statements reflect a hostility to the free exercise of religion? Those are the questions surrounding the nomination of Michigan attorney Michael Bogren. Missouri Senator Josh Hawley, a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, joins me in just a moment. And speaking of judges, the Supreme Court yesterday handed down rulings that sidestep the heart of the current abortion debate. But based upon the opinion of Justice Thomas, the court will soon have to return to the conundrum the court created back in 1973. Kevin Daly, Supreme Court reporter with the Daily Caller, is here to break that story down. As I mentioned yesterday, Netflix is threatening to boycott Georgia if their pro-life bill is enacted into law. Well, who stands to lose, Netflix or Georgia? I would believe it's the former. Justin Danhoff, general counsel for the National Center for Public Policy Research, fills us in on the details. Speaking of pro-life laws, Louisiana is poised to pass its version of the heartbeat bill. The author, Senator John Milkovich, will join us with an update a little bit later in the program. The trade war between the U.S. and China appears to be escalating as reports suggest China may limit exports of rare earth materials essential to U.S. industry. There are also suggestions China, one of the largest holders of U.S. debt, may sell the debt impacting the U.S. economy. Can China afford to get tough with the U.S.? China expert Gordon Chang joins us on this edition of Washington Watch. Buckle up. A lot of ground to cover in this edition of Washington Watch. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you're on Twitter, it's at T. Perkins. All right, my first guest, Republican Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri, grilled Michael Bogren, a federal trial court nominee, last Wednesday over his comparison of a devout Catholic family that owns a farm in Michigan to the KKK. This is a clip of the exchange that took place in the Senate Judiciary Committee last week.
You think that the Catholic families pointing to the teachings of their church is equivalent to a KKK member invoking Christianity?
From a legal perspective.
You can just give me a yes or no answer
on that. From a legal perspective, Senator.
Can you say no?
There is no distinction.
So the answer is yes.
Joining me now is Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri. As I mentioned, he serves on the Senate Judiciary Committee as well as the Armed Services Committee, the Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee. Senator, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, Senator, I watched the exchange last week. I watched the committee hearing. You gave ample opportunity for Mr. Bogren to back away from his comments, equating a Catholic couple who refused to host a same-sex wedding on their property, being barred then by the city of East Lansing from engaging in a farmer's market because of those religious beliefs. There, the attorney for the city equated that couple with the views of the KKK. Is that essentially what he said?
Yeah, well, that's exactly what he said, and he also compared them to radical Islamic imams who want to strip away the rights of women. I mean, Tony, I'm a lawyer. I understand that when you're a lawyer, you want to give your client the vigorous defense, but you can do that without engaging in hateful comparisons. And here's another excerpt of the same lawyer's brief in the same case. I'm quoting him now. He said, plaintiffs, meaning the Catholic family, attempt to dress up their arguments in a shimmering gown of First Amendment and religious righteousness and parade it down the runway of moral superiority. But when stripped of its costume, what lurks beneath is simply discriminatory conduct, end quote. I mean, the whole brief is filled with this kind of language, which Mr. Bogren stood by and said he saw no problem with in the hearing. And I just think that's incredible.
Well, Senator, he's made statements beyond the briefs that he's filed in this case. He said, defending his position, he said, quote, the message isn't Catholics need not apply. He told this to the Lansing State Journal back in September 2017. He said, quote, the message is discriminators need not apply. This is not about religion. This is not about speech, end quote. Now, my question is, how can he make that claim? If you hold to your Orthodox faith as a Catholic couple, the teachings of Jesus that taught that marriage is between one man and one woman, can you still engage in commerce under Bogren's view?
Well, it appears not. And the fact that he would say that it really has nothing to do with faith, that the Catholic family's position has nothing to do with faith, is just jaw-dropping. And he also accused them of being insincere in their faith. He said, and he argued in court, that they were only interested selectively in the teachings of their church. They only followed the teachings of their church and the teachings of the Bible on marriage selectively. And those are his words. I think he said quite selectively. I mean, this is really extraordinary stuff. And here's the bigger point, Tony. The United States Supreme Court said just last year that government officials must not engage in this kind of discriminatory language and rhetoric toward people of faith. And yet that's exactly what this gentleman chose to do. And again, he could have defended his clients if he was going to defend these people, the city, that is. He could have defended them in any number of ways. But he chose over and over and over again to use this kind of anti-faith language. And I just think it's very disturbing.
Well, you make reference to the Supreme Court case with out of Colorado with Masterpiece Cakes, where the Colorado Human Rights Commission essentially made similar parallels of the owner of Masterpiece Cakes, suggesting that, he was racist and just a horrible individual because he was seeking to operate his business according to his faith. What's disturbing here about this is that this is kind of the Obama-era freedom of worship. You can do whatever you want within the four walls of your church, at least for now, but don't you dare bring that faith into the marketplace or into the public square. Isn't that essentially what he's saying?
Yeah, it is. It is what he's saying. And the Supreme Court was quite clear in that Masterpiece Cake Shop case that the government officials who compare sincere religious beliefs, people's sincere Christian faith, compare that to slavery, compare that to the Holocaust, which is what happened in the Masterpiece case. Justice Kennedy said that's not permissible. And in fact, that was the grounds for reversing the decision against the Baker in that case. And yet here with this judicial nominee, we have him defending the city of East Lansing by doing the same thing, choosing over and over to compare a Catholic family to the KKK, to radical Islam, questioning their sincerity, saying that their position is no different than a white applicants only sign. That's another quote from his brief. I mean, it's really extraordinary stuff. And I just can't believe he would choose to engage in this kind of hateful rhetoric.
You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. So glad to have you with us. My guest, Josh Hawley, senator from Missouri, member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, discussing the nomination of Michael Bogren to the federal court. And I'm very disturbed because I've seen this type of stuff in the last administration and who they advanced. And I know how this works with home state senators, Michigan having two Democratic senators. So I understand how that works. But what disturbs me more than Bogren's actions and comments are some of my conservative friends, but conservatives who are defending him, saying that, well, he was an attorney for East Lansing, for the city, and so therefore he had to do their bidding. Excuse me, but as an attorney, you are not an indentured servant. You have a choice as to whether or not you're going to take a case and how you're going to argue that case.
Yeah, indeed. And again, I'm an attorney myself, Tony. I practiced in private practice and represented many a client. And you choose the argument that you make. I mean, sure, you've got to give your client a vigorous defense. Of course you do. But you get to choose how you do that. And the fact of the matter is that this individual chose repeatedly, over a period of time, as you point out, to engage in anti-faith, anti-Catholic rhetoric over and over and over again. That was his choice. He didn't have to defend the city by doing that, but that's what he chose to do, and that, I think, is what's so disturbing.
Well, he used very loaded language. As you said, he could have used other analogies or parallels, but to say that those who practice their faith, this Catholic couple, that it's equivalent to the Ku Klux Klan or to a radical Islamist, I mean, that is very loaded language, and, you know, is offensive. It's offensive to me. I think it's offensive to Catholics. It's offensive to Christians. It's offensive to people who believe the Bible. And, you know, to another argument that some conservatives, conservative pundits are putting out there is that, well, this questioning of his arguments for his clients could open the door for Democrats to do the same thing to other nominees that are conservative that are put before the court. Well, quite frankly, if they, whoever has a questionable record of arguing against the First Amendment, I think anybody and everybody should question them.
Oh, I agree completely. And Democrats, listen, I sit on the Senate Judiciary Committee. Democrats regularly question the rhetoric and language that is used by applicants up before that committee, and they're not going to stop. I mean, the real question is, what's the substance? What are we talking about? I don't think anybody believes that if somebody was up before the Judiciary Committee and they had used racist language defending a client, that we should all just look the other way. I mean, we'd all say, oh, my gosh, no, that's not permissible. And this is a similar thing. I mean, when you are comparing sincere believers to the KKK and to radical Islamists, as you said, I mean, that's really, that is beyond the pale, or it should be beyond the pale. And again, that was his choice in how he defended this judicial nominee. That was his choice in how he defended his clients. And he did it over and over. He did it to the press, as you point out, Tony, and he did it multiple times in court and in court filings. And, you know, I think that we've got to say at some point that, look, that just isn't acceptable.
Well, again, I know how the process works with the blue slips and such working in a Democratic state. And in the president, he has established a stellar record when it comes to the Supreme Court, the appellate courts, and even the federal courts, most of the picks. So this is not a reflection on him, but I think it's more of a reflection on the Republicans, quite frankly, as you have raised these issues to a level of public awareness that to advance someone who is hostile to the free exercise of religion, when the Republicans have the ability to either advance or not advance this nomination, I'd have to say shame on the Republicans, because this is such a fundamental issue that we've been fighting for so long, and this administration has been a champion on religious freedom. This nomination should not see the light of day, in my view.
Well, and, you know, just to underscore what you say about the president, he has been a tremendous supporter, advocate, and champion of religious freedom. I don't think for a minute the president knows about these comments. I suspect that even at the beginning of the vetting process for the judge, I mean, the White House didn't know about these comments because this litigation has been ongoing while this individual has been going through the confirmation process. So, you know, it is what it is. But my job as a United States senator on the Judiciary Committee is to stand up for our values and to stand up for the Constitution and the First Amendment. And that means asking the tough questions. And when you find behavior like this and conduct like this and anti-faith rhetoric like this, I think you got to call it out.
Well, and let me tell you what, Senator Hawley, I think a lot of Americans stand with you in that process. You gave him ample opportunity to back away from those comments. He refused to do it. He wants to own those comments. So I say let him own it. And you keep standing your ground, because I think a lot of folks are going to stand with you.
Well, thank you, Tony. I'm just doing my job. Thank you very much.
Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri. All right, we're going to continue our discussion of the courts. We come back to the Supreme Court yesterday, sidestepping some major rulings on the abortion issue, although there's some insightful information in the opinions. We're going to look at that next. Don't go away.
There is unprecedented religious persecution around the globe. In recent years, research has found increasing governmental and social hostility towards religious believers worldwide. For the last 10 years, Christians have been harassed in more countries, including the United States, than any other religious group. While the specific threats to religious freedom vary in type and intensity, one common source is the legal and cultural support for apostasy, blasphemy, and anti-conversion laws, which often threaten the freedom to choose or change one's faith. In a new publication from Family Research Council, we list which nations around the world have these unjust laws on the books and spotlight people who have faced severe penalties simply for sharing or changing their faith. For more information on religious hostility due to apostasy, blasphemy, and anti-conversion laws around the world, visit frc.org/ABA laws. That's frc.org/ABA laws.
When you look at what is going on in our country and culture today, do you often ask, what can I do? Well, mark your calendar for the Values Voters Summit on October 11th through 13th in Washington, D.C., and join thousands of Americans just like you who want to change the culture in a way that human life is valued, families flourish, and religious liberty thrives. Past speakers include President Donald Trump, Vice President Mike Pence, Secretary Mike Pompeo, Kirk Cameron, Dana Loesch, and Ben Carson. In addition, there will be opportunities to meet with organizations and attendees that share a Christian worldview, and informational sessions focused on the topics of life, religious liberty, the LGBT movement, national security, the realities of socialism, and more. On October 11th through 13th, stand with thousands of Values voters to restore our great nation. Registration is now open. Don't miss the early bird price of $99. Visit valuesvotersummit.org for more information. That's valuesvotersummit.org.
Your email inbox is probably filled with a lot of free stuff these days. Free is good, but most of our email ends up being free spam. If you want a healthier diet in your inbox, add Tony Perkins' Washington Update newsletter to your email menu. This daily update from Family Research Council is our flagship publication, an update with the latest pro-family take on Washington's hottest issues. The update goes beyond the headlines and examines what is really going on in our culture and politics from a biblical perspective. Are evangelicals showing up at the polls? Are faith-based adoption providers persecuting same-sex couples? The left and the media love to answer these questions for you. Let FRC remove the spin and give you real answers with the Washington Update. To subscribe to this free daily newsletter and to subscribe to other free resources, go to frc.org/connect. That's frc.org/connect.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins, your host. The website is tonyperkins.com. All right, yesterday, the Supreme Court reached an apparent compromise in an abortion dispute from Indiana, keeping the issue off its dockets as abortion is taking center stage in the 2020 presidential race. Now, the justices apparently reinstated a rule providing for humane disposal of fetal remains, but left a lower court ruling striking down the state's trait-selective abortion ban untouched. Now, this is the abortion ban in Indiana coming out of the Seventh Circuit. Then-Governor Mike Pence signed these bills into law. Simply said there's no sex selection, or if a baby has Downs, you can't abort the baby based on that. Well, in a separate opinion, Justice Clarence Thomas said the states have a compelling interest in ensuring abortion does not become a tool of eugenics. And he goes into Planned Parenthood. It's a very, very interesting opinion, and also gives us a few signs of what is going on behind the scenes in the court and what we may see soon, and whether or not they're waiting for another case on abortion that could, in fact, challenge Roe v. Wade. Joining now to talk about this is Kevin Daly. He's the Supreme Court reporter for the Daily Caller. Kevin, welcome to Washington Watch.
Hi, Tony. Pleasure to be with you and your listeners.
Well, Kevin, did I break it down fairly? Fill in the details on what the court did yesterday on these two abortion cases.
Yeah, I think your summary was exactly right. And I think I would just describe the features of this compromise in general terms. As you said, the liberals sort of get a victory in that the Supreme Court did not address Indiana's ban on so-called eugenic abortions. Advocates of the law cast it as an anti-eugenic measure because, as you said, it bans abortions on the basis of race, sex, or disability. Conservatives get a win in that the regulations providing for the humane disposal of fetal remains are restored, are reinstated. They had been enjoined by a lower court. But this, you know, ultimately, I think, cuts slightly in the favor of the court's liberal bloc, because the lower court, in judging the fetal remains provisions, did not strike them down under Planned Parenthood versus Casey's undue burden test, right? As you know, Tony, we live in a universe in which abortion regulations are not governed by Roe versus Wade, but right, by the successor Planned Parenthood versus Casey case, which provides that no law that imposes an undue burden on a woman's right to abortion can be sustained under the Constitution. Instead, Planned Parenthood challenged the fetal remains provision under a very permissive legal test called rational basis review. And the court, using rational basis review, reinstated the fetal remains provision. So this decision also leaves totally undisturbed the court's undue burden precedents, and liberals will be very happy about that.
Yeah, speaking of Casey, Planned Parenthood versus Casey, Clarence Thomas, the only justice that was on the court back then, who is there now, he writes, given the potential for an abortion to become a tool of eugenic manipulation, the court will soon need to confront the constitutionality of laws like Indiana's. But because further percolation may assist our review of this issue of first impression, I join the court in declining to take up the issue now, end quote. Is that a suggestion that the court is just waiting for the right abortion case to come before it that would, in fact, touch back to Planned Parenthood versus Casey?
Yeah, I think that that's generally right, Tony. Now, as a general matter, the court, as Justice Thomas said, doesn't like to take issues of first impression. Instead, it likes to wait for multiple courts to weigh in on the same question of law before it itself gets involved. Now, this is the first time that a federal court has reviewed a so-called anti-eugenic abortion ban. So I think what Justice Thomas is doing here is what's called docket setting. He's encouraging other states to adopt bans on eugenic abortions so that those bans can be litigated in other courts, allowing other courts to weigh in, and thereby allowing the issue to return to the Supreme Court. And what he does subsequently in the opinion is explain why he believes, as you said, states have a compelling interest in adopting an anti-eugenic abortion ban, and sort of lays out a roadmap for where he wants to go. Now, what's interesting is that no other justice joined Justice Thomas's concurrence. He was writing solely for himself. That's not unusual. Justice Thomas is a prodigious opinion writer, and often he goes out on his own quest, so to speak. But it's not clear that there are other conservative justices are with him, or at least they chose not to signal that they were yesterday.
Were you surprised by his, as he talked about the eugenics, that he went into the history of Planned Parenthood?
You know, it seemed obvious that he has wanted to weigh in on this issue for a long time. His historic research was pretty exhaustive and highly detailed. He canvassed the entire history of the 20th century birth control movement, and his read of that history is that the birth control movement was intertwined with the contemporaneous eugenics movement, which wanted to, you know, subdue the growth of racial minority populations and populations of people with disability. And so it seems, given the thoroughness of his research, that he's wanted to weigh in on this issue for a long time. But a number of people were taken aback, by the lengths to which he went yesterday.
Now, we have a number of abortion-related cases that are making their way to the Supreme Court. They're in the pipeline to get to the Supreme Court. What do you think, and as an observer of the Supreme Court, what's the time frame in which you think it'll take the court to take up one of those cases?
You know, a lot of people are of the view that the court is trying to avoid abortion disputes in the aftermath of Justice Kavanaugh's confirmation. And indeed, the newly entrenched conservative majority has had three opportunities this term to move against pro-choice precedents. They have declined each time. Back in December, the court denied review of a lower court issue involving state funding for abortions and for Planned Parenthood. Back in February, the court, on a 5-4 vote with Chief Justice Roberts joining the liberals, allowed a Louisiana regulation providing that physicians who perform abortions must have admitting privileges at a local hospital to go into effect. And then we had this compromise yesterday. So it does seem like the court is trying to avoid abortion disputes at the moment. We're pretty deep into the court's term at this juncture. The justices will be adjourning for the summer in June. So if they do decide to take any abortion case on the merits at this stage, we would not hear arguments in that case until the end of this year, with a decision following in June of 2020, which is sort of the curious thing about the court's attempt to avoid abortion disputes right now. It seems like it's doing so because it wants to keep a low profile.
Mm-hmm.
Possible that it's setting up a scenario in which it issues a major abortion ruling in the middle of a presidential election.
Well, that would be something. Kevin Daly, thank you so much for joining us. Great insight. Appreciate you sharing it with us.
Great to be with you, Tony. Take care.
All right, Kevin Daly with The Daily Caller. All right, talking about Netflix next. Don't go away. We're back with more.
Grandpa Jerry, what are you doing?
What? What does it look like I'm doing? I'm sitting on this bench enjoying my tea and reading the news.
You always tell me that I need to stand firm for faith, family, and freedom. Why aren't you standing?
Well, now with this new Stand Firm app, I can sit and stand at the same time. And if you got the Stand Firm app, you could learn something besides that garbage of peddling in public schools. You could listen to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. We're Tony and leaders on the Hill and other culture influencers weigh in on current events. You can read FRC's latest publications and articles responding to what's going on in the news, like this.
Oh.
You can play trivia and earn points for free prizes. You can even access all of FRC's publications directly to sharpen your mind and give you the ability to discern the thoughts and intentions of the heart.
I can be a mind reader?
Kid, that's from the Bible, the richest piece of literature on God's green earth.
Can I see this stand-up? Wow, this would keep me informed. Visit frc.org/app to download FRC's Stand Firm app.
Your email inbox is probably filled with a lot of free stuff these days. Free is good, but most of our email ends up being free spam. If you want a healthier diet in your inbox, add Tony Perkins' Washington Update newsletter to your email menu. This daily update from Family Research Council is our flagship publication, an update with the latest pro-family take on Washington's hottest issues. The update goes beyond the headlines and examines what is really going on in our culture and politics from a biblical perspective. Are evangelicals showing up at the polls? Are faith-based adoption providers persecuting same-sex couples? The left and the media love to answer these questions for you. Let FRC remove the spin and give you real answers with the Washington Update. To subscribe to this free daily newsletter and to subscribe to other free resources, go to frc.org/connect. That's frc.org/connect.
This is Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. The website is tonyperkins.com. All right, Netflix will continue to film in Georgia despite backlash surrounding the state's heartbeat bill that bans abortions after 6 weeks. But the streaming giant would reconsider if the controversial bill actually goes into law, into effect. Now, Netflix content officer Ted Sarandos told Fox News, quote, "We have many women working on productions in Georgia whose rights, along with millions of others, will be severely restricted by this law. It's why we work with the ACLU and others to fight it in court. Given the legislation has not yet been implemented, we'll continue to film there while also supporting partners and artists who choose not to. Should it ever come into effect, we'd rethink our entire investment in Georgia." Now, the reason they're in Georgia is because Georgia, like Louisiana did before, back when I was in the legislature in Louisiana, we adopted very generous rebates to the film industry to get them to film in our state. It was not very lucrative for us. We gave away more than I think that came in. Georgia, you know, trumped what we did, and they drew a lot of the film industry there. The reason they're leaving Hollywood is because it costs so much. So are they really considering leaving Georgia because of this policy? What is the bottom line for Netflix and those like them coming out of Hollywood? Joining me now to talk about this story in greater depth is Justin Danhoff. He's the general counsel for the National Center for Public Policy Research. Justin, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Hey, thanks so much, Tony. I really appreciate it.
What do you think about Netflix in terms of, are they, first off, there's really no fear that this law is going to go into effect anytime soon. So they're putting this out there knowing that it's not going to go into effect. But the bottom line for them is money. And just like we saw in North Carolina, where all those companies threatening to leave North Carolina over the bathroom bill, the economy continues to thrive in North Carolina. Is this more bluster out of Hollywood?
Well, it's partly blustered, but you have to know the folks at the top of Netflix. Reed Hastings is the CEO, and he is, you know, part and parcel of the liberal justice social warrior, you know, as a CEO. And he is a true believer in liberal causes, to the point that the entire board he has surrounded himself, including the liar Susan Rice of Benghazi fame, are all dyed-in-the-wool liberals as well. So you've got a leadership issue at this company. Of course, they gave a huge contract to the Obamas, who have no history in the business whatsoever. So I wouldn't be surprised if they would follow through on the economic threat that they're making to the Peach State right now. And let's not forget, there has been economic threats against the Peach State in the past that were successful. In 2016, when the legislature there passed a state-level religious freedom law, we had the National Football League come out and say, if Governor Deal signs that bill, the Super Bowl will never, ever be held in Atlanta. Disney and AMC Networks at the time both threatened to withdraw. Coca-Cola and Home Depot, both big companies in the state of Georgia, they also spoke out against the legislation, and Governor Deal vetoed the bill.
Yeah, well, he folded.
My point being,
Deal folded. I mean, he was weak, and I think you're right. I mean, that only emboldens them to do more of this. This is why, you know, you basically you don't negotiate with these people. Because they're going to see weakness. But when you compare that to North Carolina, North Carolina held their ground and their economy continues to thrive. And all those who threaten to leave, I don't know that any of them have actually left because the environment is conducive for business.
That's exactly right. So, you know, at the end of the day, we'll see what happens. You're right. This is going to be a long legal battle and a legal process. But what we have too is a situation where not only the tops of these corporations, many of them in Silicon Valley, but when they hear from, I engage with companies, you know, constantly, and I hear this constant refrain that we're only doing this because it's what our employees tell us they want. When companies donate to Planned Parenthood, I hear that. When companies fund the Human Rights Campaign, I hear that. And so the concern is we've got an extension of the college campus now entering into corporate America, right? Where conservative employees and Christian employees, they don't feel free to speak their mind at their place of work, so the liberal employees take over. It's a squeaky wheel situation, right? And mm-hmm. we see that in shareholder activism as well. There's 90 groups on the left that pressure companies to move even further to the left. And I'm the one that's out there pressuring them not to move to the right, simply to stay neutral. Netflix should have no role in this culture debate over life. They should not be involved in it. It doesn't involve their business. It's not like we're debating some sort of tax policy or tariff or regulation that actually would affect Netflix. So my message to these companies is you have no role in the culture debates. You have no role in these discussions. And the problem is there's so many voices on the other side pushing them to get engaged in these debates and to use their economic heft to harm certain regions and at least make an economic threat.
Yeah.
And sometimes we've seen those economic threats have effect. And so until we speak up more inside of these corporations, empower the conservatives and the Christians that work at these companies to use their voices and the investors, because, you know, investors come in all stripes, but only liberal investors speak up. We need to empower other investors to use their voice.
I agree. I absolutely agree. I think they should be neutral. That's why I like Dunkin' Donuts. They came out and said, we don't do politics, we do donuts. And I prefer their donuts over their politics. So, all right, Justin, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate your thoughts. All right, folks, don't go away. Coming back, the trade war between the U.S. and China. What might be next? Gordon Chang is here. Don't go away.
In states like New York, Virginia, and Vermont, radical legislation has been written legalizing abortion late in pregnancy, when babies can feel pain and are able to live outside the womb.
Happy birthday to you.
They've gone even further, repealing protections of infants born alive, allowing killing even after birth.
Happy birthday, dear.
Congress has yet to protect the life of every newborn baby. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com to send Nancy Pelosi a newborn hat to show Congress every new life should be welcomed with warmth and love, not hate, not death. End birthday abortions. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com.
Happy birthday to you.
Paid for by Family Research Council.
The latest Trojan horse on Capitol Hill is called the Equality Act. The way the left is advertising this bill is misleading because it does not further equality at all. It would actually violate current protections in place that allow private institutions and people of faith to freely act in accordance to their deeply held beliefs. The Equality Act explicitly removes religious liberty protections that were originally put in place with bipartisan support. Its stated goal is equality, but its actual result is harm to vast members of communities, individuals, and Americans as a whole by undercutting our foundational freedom of religion. Is this really what equality looks like? A more fitting name for the Equality Act would be the Inequality Act. For more information on the mass threat of the Equality Act, visit frc.org/EqualityAct2019. That's frc.org/EqualityAct2019.
Your email inbox is probably filled with a lot of free stuff these days. Free is good, but most of our email ends up being free spam. If you want a healthier diet in your inbox, add Tony Perkins' Washington Update newsletter to your email menu. This daily update from Family Research Council is our flagship publication, an update with the latest pro-family take on Washington's hottest issues. The update goes beyond the headlines and examines what is really going on in our culture and politics from a biblical perspective. Are evangelicals showing up at the polls? Are faith-based adoption providers persecuting same-sex couples? The left and the media love to answer these questions for you. Let FRC remove the spin and give you real answers with the Washington Update. To subscribe to this free daily newsletter and to subscribe to other free resources, go to frc.org/connect. That's frc.org/connect.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. The website, TonyPerkins.com. I know we're covering a lot of territory, a lot of ground today. If you miss anything, you can check it all out later at TonyPerkins.com. It's archived there. Hopefully, I'll be able to give you some of my thoughts before we wrap up today on some of these topics. But a lot happening, even though Congress is they're on a break, the Memorial Day break. They'll be back next week. But one of the issues that we've talked about before that continues to unfold is the trade negotiations with China. Now, some argue we're in a trade war with China, and they're starting to make moves that suggest that they're going to push back and may push back in a hard way. Joining me now to talk about this, Gordon Chang, author of The Coming Collapse of China. Gordon, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Well, thank you so much, Tony.
All right, where do things stand right now with China and the United States in terms of the trade negotiations?
Well, the tensions are ramping up very fast. Beijing three times this month has declared war on the United States. And they're not talking about trade war or economic war. They're using terms which traditionally have been used by Beijing to talk about real war. So they talk about people's war. They talk about core interests, which in Communist Party lingo are to be defended by force. So at this particular time, Beijing is certainly ramping up the rhetorical guns against us.
Now, one of the issues or one of the items that's been discussed is the potential for them to sell off U.S. debt, which they hold. They're one of the countries with the largest amount of U.S. debt. That could affect the U.S. economy. Also, we've heard about the rare earth, the minerals that are necessary for certain industries in the United States, that they would slow down the exports of those. Where are we most vulnerable when it comes to China?
I think there are a couple of things. One of them would be for China to sell U.S. equities. In other words, try to plunge the Dow. The other thing is rare earths, as you mentioned, because they are used in many critical components for our military and, of course, on common consumer items like cell phones and nuts and the like.
There, China holds a near monopoly of global production. They produce about 80% of the world's rare earths at this time. They don't have 80% of the deposits. They have maybe only 40%, but they're the ones who have perfected manufacturing. In terms of holding U.S. Treasury debt, that's not a real weapon for a number of reasons. But nonetheless, China has a number of things that it could do to the United States, which could cause pain. But, you know, we've just got to accept it because this is an existential struggle.
Now, Gordon, we've talked about this before, but China's economy and they're not in the strongest of positions to take on the United States. And as you say, this is about more than just trade. This is about who is going to be setting the stage, you know, as the world leader and who's going to be basically setting the parameters for the future.
Well, yes, because what China wants to do is certainly compete with us. And that's fair. Every country competes with us. But what China is trying to do is take down the global system as we know it. So, for instance, we leave in the global commons of international airspace and waters. China is trying to take over that. They're trying to dismember their neighbors. They are taking down the global trading system by engaging in predatory practices. And, of course, stealing U.S. intellectual property to the tune of somewhere between $150 to $600 billion a year. So these are things which are just incompatible with the world as we know it. And to defend that system, which has created prosperity for so many countries since the end of the Second World War, we have to oppose what China's doing.
So, Gordon, would it be your sense that it's one of those situations where we can either face this now and deal with it, or we're going to have to deal with it later?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we should have been dealing with this decades earlier. And that time would have been a lot easier for us to do so. It'll be a lot more difficult in the future. So this is the perfect time. Because as you mentioned, Tony, the Chinese economy right now is fragile. Ours is robust. And also China's so dependent on us. Last year, China's merchandise surplus with the U.S. was 129.6% of its overall surplus. So you can see the overwhelming dependence on the access to the U.S. market.
Well, in fact, the United States in the last 20 years with the most favored nation, permanent most favored nation status with China, we've grown their economy. The exchange with the United States has benefited them tremendously.
Oh, certainly. You know, in 1999, when the Clinton administration came to agreement with China and that agreement paved its way for entry into the World Trade Organization, that was really premature. And we've sort of nurtured China, gave it really easy status and opened access to the U.S. market at a time when that was not justified, because China has not accepted the notion of comparative advantage, which underlines international commerce. Yet we let them into the system of international commerce with accession to the World Trade Organization. That was just wrong policy.
Gordon Chang, last time we spoke a couple of weeks ago, you said that the Trump administration making all the right moves. They continue to make the right moves, holding firm?
Yes, I believe so. You know, the president, since we talked, issued an emergency order against foreign adversaries supplying telecom equipment. Now, we've added Huawei Technologies, which is the premier Chinese telecom equipment manufacturer, to the Commerce Department's entity list. We've given them a reprieve, which we probably shouldn't have, but nonetheless, we're moving in the right direction. And so we've got to disentangle our two economies, and we've got to make sure that we do not have Huawei equipment in our infrastructure, in our backbone, telecom backbone, because they abuse that to spy on us.
Yeah, I think they just cut you out on what you were saying there. Yeah, that's actually a conversation, a whole nother conversation. I've spoken to some military experts and the concerns that surround that technology. Gordon, I've got to leave it there. I want to thank you so much. As always, great to talk with you. Thanks for keeping us up to date on the relations with China.
And thank you, Tony.
All right, Gordon Chang. Always fascinating. And it's something we've got to keep our eye on. Not something that, you know, we always focus on, but it is very important. And this Chinese technology that he made reference to, I may do a program just on that. It is quite significant. what the Chinese are doing through their technology here in the United States to basically spy on America. All right, I think we're going to get an update real quick from the author of the heartbeat bill in Louisiana, John Milkovich, Senator John Milkovich, Democrat from North Louisiana. Senator, are you with us? Senator, are you there?
Yes, I am. How are you?
I'm fine, yeah. John. Good to hear from you. Give us the latest on the heartbeat bill.
Tony, I wish if I was an adept a legislator as you were, I would have been handling these phone calls better, and I apologize. Listen, great news. We do not have final passage in the House yet, but what we have with the heartbeat bill, which makes it, as you know, illegal to kill unborn babies after a fetal heartbeat is detected, three bad amendments have been defeated. There's now an amendment being considered or being discussed that would strengthen the heartbeat bill, and we believe that there may be a vote on final passage on the Louisiana heartbeat bill within the next 10 minutes. So you're right on top of the developing news curve as always, but we were very excited, and of course, we thank Woody Jenkins, you and Mike Cross, and many others that have been fighting this battle in the state capitol against the abortion industry and for the lives of the unborn, Tony. We thank you for everything you've done, and we feel like if we can do our small part to build on the work that, you know, the giants that went before us performed, that you know, we can do something.
Well, you're doing an outstanding job. This is quite significant. Louisiana joining the ranks of the other states, advancing these heartbeat bills. Have you spoken to the governor? He had indicated he's going to sign it once the House passes it. Have you talked to him about it?
You know, I really have not, but I have read his statements to the newspapers that he intends to sign it. So obviously, that's good news, and we're very grateful that. Governor John Bel Edwards has honestly signed every anti-abortion pro-life bill that we've gotten to his desk. So yeah, we're encouraged. And
Senator Milkovich,
I'm looking to see if we've got a final vote yet. I'm walking over to the House side to see.
I wanted to say this while I have you on the program. Of course, we've spoken many, many times. But hearken back to the conservative Democrats that I served with in the House that advanced these core values that we share pro-family, pro-life legislators. You've fought the Common Core. You've advanced family policy. And now you are the author, and you will successfully here in just a few moments passed the heartbeat bill there in the state of Louisiana. So I thank you for your leadership and congratulate you.
Oh, listen, thank you so much for everything that you've done to help us, Tony. You're a leader in our state, and we're so proud of you because your leadership has transcended the boundaries of our state, and you are providing leadership across America. So we're so appreciative of what you're doing. And we may be getting close to a vote. And I don't want to hold you. I know you've got other topics.
No, that's fine. I tell you what, I'm gonna address one issue. And
yes,
I'm gonna, if you don't mind holding for just a minute, as soon as we get a vote, I want to get you on the air to announce that vote.
Sure.
There's a couple minutes left in the program.
Sure.
So
stay
with me for
a
moment. All right. Senator John Milkovich of Louisiana represents North Louisiana on the House floor, actually, right now, as his Senate bill is up for a final vote. There were several amendments that were introduced today, three to be precise, that tried to add to it, water the bill down. But those, as he mentioned earlier, successfully fended off. I want to go back very quickly while we're waiting for this vote. To the issue we talked about at the beginning of the program with Senator Hawley, and that was the issue of this judge out of Michigan who equated this Catholic family with the KKK. Now, this is a family that had a retreat center, a farm, where they had events, weddings, and they refused to do same-sex weddings there, like many people of faith just don't want to be a part of celebrating it. Now, they also grew blueberries on that farm, and they would sell those in the local farmers market in East Lansing, Michigan. Well, they said they can't sell it here because they discriminate. And so that's what Michael Bogren, the attorney for East Lansing, was arguing, that they had no right to sell because they discriminated. And that's really the whole issue, is that we have a family operating their business according to their religious faith. And so you have an attorney arguing that there's no room for them in the public square as a result. Now, an attorney can certainly have that opinion, but he should not be on the federal courts. And I find that, quite frankly, and I think I said this last week, I find that offensive that he would equate Orthodox Christian biblical views, the same views that Jesus articulated in Matthew, that marriage is between a man and a woman, making that equivalent to the racial bigotry and hatred of the Ku Klux Klan. That's something that would come out of the Southern Poverty Law Center, you know, that cesspool of bigotry and discrimination that they've been proven to be. But anyway, you need to call your senators. You can call the U.S. senators, Capitol Switchboard number 202-225-3121, 202-225-3121, or better yet, make sure you have the Stand Firm app and download that, and that way you can act on all of these issues in real time. All right, we're going to go back before we run out of time here. We're up at the end of the program. I'm going to get Senator Milkovich back on the line. Senator, are you still with us?
Yes. Yes, Tony. Yes.
All right. Do we have a vote yet?
No, we do not have a final vote. I think we may be on the last amendment. So far, every amendment has been defeated, including one that would have strengthened the bill. I think we're on the last amendment before a final vote on final passage.
Now, from everything I've heard in speaking to some of the lawmakers, it's anticipated this is going to pass overwhelmingly out of the House.
Praise God. I hope it does.
Well, I'm asking you to confirm that because you're right there. But that's what I've heard, that it's got strong support there in the House.
Well, that is a great I love that message. And, you know, I'm just praying and knowing that Representative Valerie Hodge has done a great job. She's worked really hard on the bill. And, I'm very hopeful.
Well, good. Well, Valerie actually sits in the seat that I used to have. She represents.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
She represents District 64, which was which is my old district. Well, Senator, we're out of time.
She thinks the world of you, Tony, and so do I.
Well, thank you, John. So good to have you on the program. Congratulations again in anticipating that bill is going to pass here in just a few moments. I want to thank you for joining us. We'll get you back on next week to talk more about it, but we're coming up into the program. So thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tony.
Senator John Milkovich of Louisiana, leading the charge in the Louisiana legislature on the heartbeat bill. All right, folks, you hear the music. That means, well, we're out of time for today. Thanks so much for joining us. Until next time, I leave you with the encouraging words of the Apostle Paul, found in Ephesians 6. Where he says, when you've done everything you can do, when you've prayed, when you've prepared, and when you have taken your stand, by all means, keep standing.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.